Welcome to the Meiji at 150 podcast. I'm your host, Tristan Gruno. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Kenneth J. Ruoff from Portland State University, where he is professor of history as well as director of the Center for Japanese Studies. Dr. Ruoff is the author of The People's Emperor, Democracy in the Japanese Monarchy, 1945 to 1995, published by Harvard in 2001, as well as Imperial Japan at its Zenith, the wartime celebration of the empire's 2600th anniversary, published by Cornell in 2010. Delighted today on the Meiji at 150 podcast to be joined by Dr. Kenneth J. Ruoff from Portland State University. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What is the place of the restoration in Japanese history more broadly, or global history even?
For me, the significance of the Meiji Restoration, and really, you know, we're talking here about Japan's drive toward modernity, is that as Japan modernizes, it proves to the world that modernity belongs to the world. Now, here we are in the 21st century, and no one really questions that. But if you go back to the 19th century, there were large numbers of Euro-Americans who believed that modernity was predicated on race, on civilization, including Christianity. And then Japan comes along, a non-white, a non-Christian country, and modernizes and pretty much blows that myth out of the water. The big sort of marquee event is Japan's victory over Mother Russia in 1905, and the whole world takes note in places, Egypt, Turkey, Vietnam, India. People take notice of this, and it convinces them that in order to become modern, you don't have to, first of all, you don't have to be white, you don't have to be Christian, but you also don't have to sell your cultural soul in order to achieve modernity. And so, you know, people start studying the lessons of Japan to try to engineer modernity in their own countries. The great shame of all this is that if Japan, by some miracle, had decided that instead of trying to be in tune with the so-called trends of the time, had decided to totally buck the trends of the time in 1905 and announced to the world, you know, we think that the international system of racism is a disgrace and we're not having anything to do with it. Because in many ways, their victory over Mother Russia is like, if you think about the international system of racism as having four pillars, they basically knock one down with their victory over Mother Russia. But of course, far from choosing that route, the Japanese go on to become all the more predatory imperialist, and it seems as though imperialism is just inseparable from some form of discrimination and racism, and the Japanese go on to develop their own racial hierarchies within their empire, with, unsurprisingly, the Japanese at the top.
And I'm reminded of, say, the work of Marius Janson, where he talks about, you know, at that time, in that political spectrum or in that kind of political environment, what choice did Japan have? And if they were following the rest of the Western countries in a project of mimesis, as say Robert S. Skilton Peter Deuce has called it, then, well, isn't it just natural that they would also choose to pursue imperialist expansion?
I think it's unsurprising. I don't think it's 100% natural, because there's always a choice, and these decisions are made by human beings. The Japanese leadership obviously decided to go that route. I mean, there were dissenting voices at the time, but it's definitely not surprising that they would go the same route as the major powers at the time, because that's kind of part of what defined a great power at the time, was precisely having an empire. And Japan, first and foremost, was concerned about Japan and getting entry into the, you know, the club, if you will. And to get entry into the club, at least through the back door, and then maybe eventually the side door, and never really from the front door, they needed an empire, among other things.
I mean, that is kind of the limit I always thought of the mimesis
argument, or the mimetic empire argument, is Japan is just copying the West and everything. So of course they're going to copy imperialism. There were, it kind of gainsays the political rationale of the Meiji leaders. I always thought, you know, they are looking around. They see Korea, for example, as this political vacuum. Think if we don't do it, somebody else is going to do it. Not to say they were justified or right in doing it, but they are rational political actors mm-hmm. who see, you know, in their own mind kind of a defensive posturing that Japan needs to undertake mm-hmm. to prevent Western incursion on what they deem to be their own territory.
Mm-hmm.
And so to just say it's copying for the sake of copying just kind of takes away their agency as political actors.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So, of course, in your publications about the emperor system and the people's emperor and Japan at its zenith, when you're talking about modernization, what role do you see for the emperor system in this modernization project?
Right. Well, one of the key aspects of modernity, I think that most historians, even though we don't have a set definition of modernity, and part of what happens at conferences is that people argue vehemently over precisely the definition of modernity. But nonetheless, most people would include the nation state. I mean, there is an argument among the people writing about nationalism about whether it's modern or you can date it back further. But still, I mean, most people at some level recognize a significant modern aspect to nationalism. And so the Meiji leaders, they need an axis. They need an axis around which to achieve unity, because it's not necessarily unified yet into a new nation state. And they dust off the imperial house and make him the symbol. And so one of the things that I think is really important, because for a long time, people in Japan, on both the left and right, have talked about the monarchy or the emperor system, whatever term you use, is something unique to Japan, and either in a good way or in a bad way. But for me, it's just another example of the nationalisms that swept the world in the late 19th century and early 20th century, and there's really nothing unique about it whatsoever. It just, if you just substitute kind of nationalism for emperor monarchy or nationalism for emperor system, then you can conveniently compare it to what happened in continental Europe and eventually happens around almost the entire world.
And in many ways, you could say what happens to the emperor system in the post-war is another type of reimagination, reconstitution of the nation centered on this focal point of the emperor, but now he's being recast in a kind of different set of robes. Whereas in the Meiji period, it's, let's put him in the Western robes and mm-hmm. we'll create this nation state around him. As you describe in your first book, it's a kind of another reconstitution. Now Japan is a peaceful democracy around a symbolic emperor.
It's true. I mean, of course it seems contradictory, but the imperial house manages to redefine itself as a symbol of democracy. And perhaps nothing is more important in this effort than the present emperor's engagement and then marriage, 1958-1959, to Michiko. And the reason it's so important, the reason that it weds the imperial house to the post-war constitution, is that he marries a commoner. And it's a so-called love match. And so there you have equality and liberty, two values fundamental to the post-war system. And so, incredibly enough, the monarchy is able to rebuild itself as a symbol of democracy. But one of the things, additional things, that people outside Japan really need to understand, and here, although I cringe as a rule when people use terms such as unique in reference to Japan, there is a specificity to this. Democracy in post-war Japan, many definitions of it among Japanese include peace. The very definition of democracy in Japan for many Japanese is peace. And you simply do not find that just about anywhere else in the world, maybe in a place like Costa Rica, there's a liberal democracy that truly doesn't have a military. But in Japan, the importance of peace and pacifism, those are not the same things, in the post-war period is just absolutely remarkable. And there is a specificity to that that I don't think is replicated anywhere else. Of course, in recent decades, you know, this has been evolving. But my goodness, I mean, Crown Prince Akihito is Crown Prince. I mean, peace, you know, peace may have been the word to come out of his mouth more than any other term during his time as Crown Prince and ever. So much so, that's another thing that the far right dislikes about the present emperor, is that he's always talking about peace, and they just get sick of it.
I'm struck by this idea that the imperial system is reinventing itself multiple times now. And, I mean, I guess if there is one thing that we might hazard to say is unique, and we certainly don't want to parrot the kind of nationalistic rhetoric of Japan having, you know, the oldest imperial system in the world. You know, you could date it back to, you know, however far, we won't go far back as 660 BCE, mm-hmm. but it is true that there has been a empire system, even if it's not a single unbroken bloodline. This institution itself has existed through many ups and downs throughout Japanese history. And it has been able to reinvent itself to respond to the current political and social milieu as a way to maybe not stay relevant, but survive.
Mm-hmm. It's very flexible. They're very bright people. They have a lot of bright people working for them. Let me just tell one anecdote, even though it's mildly embarrassing for me. When I first started my research on what became the People's Emperor, I asked a journalist who'd long been in the Imperial Household Press Club. I asked him, do the Imperial family members read much of what's written about them? He looked at me as though I had a lot to learn, which I did. And he said, they read everything. They read everything that's written about him. In fact, there's a section in the Imperial Household Agency that's charged with cutting out those articles and forwarding them to each particular Imperial family member so that the Imperial family member can sort of judge how his or her performance is playing out at the popular level. And they are constantly making adjustments. And so in the contemporary sense, there was one Chamberlain who said at one point that it's like we're fighting an election every day of the week in order to stay relevant to the Japanese people. You know, there is this interesting question. When you've got an imperial line that empirically, you know, no one really disagrees that it dates back to maybe, you know, the 6th or the 5th or maybe even a little earlier, 4th century AD, why do you need to go to this immense trouble to create a fiction that takes it back to 660 BC. Well, of course, the original, myth-making occurred at a time that the imperial house was not that old. And with the Kojiki and the Nihon Shoki, and they're trying to say that an institution that's actually relatively new is much older than it is. But if you fast forward to the present, why do you need to continue with this nonsense when you've got 1,600 years in your favor? And it probably boils down to the fact that if you can take it back before the time of Christ, then you're older than Christian civilization. And then the trouble with the empirical dates is they're right around the time that Japan is borrowing a lot from China. And so if you can take it back further, then supposedly you can construct a pure Japanese, culture and all, and that it all originated before Christ, and it originated before Chinese influences came into Japan. But it is, 1,600 years is pretty good. If you're going to drape yourself in being ancient in order to achieve legitimacy, then that would seem to be enough to begin with.
And if they're, I never heard that they were reading the newspaper every day.
They take very seriously how each one of their acts, which is, of course, a performance. The best type of imperial performance, of course, is one that is so perfectly planned that it actually comes across as spontaneous, okay? I mean, you can almost make an analogy to a Japanese garden, and that the whole point is that it's so perfectly pruned that it looks as though, in fact, there's no human hand, when, in fact, immense thought has gone into each tiny little clipping. Well, the perfect imperial performance is when it seems, and the people are there, it's like, wow, he just, like, spontaneously, you know, said this and this, and it's like, no, there's nothing spontaneous about that. But then afterwards, then there's the careful evaluation of how did this play out? Is this something we want to stick with, or do we want to adjust? And sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes, like, people are kind of like, they start reading that from in the newspapers that the people didn't appreciate some symbolic act, and then they just quickly change gears.
And with such reaction to the popular will, they really are the people's emperor.
This is something that aggravates the far right to no end, but even scholars who are on the far right, this is why they want to change it. They've had to concede that there's no other way to interpret the post-war constitution than under popular sovereignty, if the people made up their minds that they wanted to get rid of the imperial house, sooner or later the politicians would have to listen, or they would just keep on voting them out. And so they have to continuously reach out to the people, wed themselves to the people. That's where the marriages can be very, very useful. And keep those people, when the poll takers come and ask, you know, do we need an imperial house? 80% of them still say yes. Mm-hmm. Keep them saying yes.
Mm-hmm. So I want to pivot now to... I want to transition to talking about the place of the Meiji Restoration in your classroom. Mm-hmm. So when you approach Japanese history pedagogically and you're sketching out your lectures, I'm curious, how do you talk about it in your classroom and how does it fit in there?
Yeah, what has proved effective, and this was not something that I just started doing right away, it definitely evolved, was to focus on this special role of Japan as the first non-white and non-Christian, non-Euro-American country to modernize. And, of course, there's some groundwork that has to be laid. I mean, the students, first of all, they have to get a sense of what, you know, how we define modernity. But, you know, most of them are familiar with the history of racism, and then they pick up pretty quickly on the fact that Japan was challenging a whole international system that said that the reason that Europe and the United States, reason they're modern is because they're white and because they have Western civilization behind them, and of course that means Christianity. And Japan comes along and just completely, you know, blows that out of the water. And the rest of the world is, especially all these people living under colonial rule, are like, whoa, you know, there's hope for us. And that has worked pretty well. I personally, the students that I teach don't have a whole lot of interest, or maybe it's me who doesn't have a whole lot of interest in the very fine detail of, like, how the Meiji Restoration played out or something, and who are the players from the court and things like that. But in broader history, in a broader sense, the modernization is, there's a real specificity to the role of Japan in global history, in being the first. And I've talked to, for example, diplomats. I don't know if you've ever had a consul general here who served in the Middle East. Those people in the Middle East could care less about the Asia-Pacific War. And, you know, it's just they absolutely could care less about that. They often have hugely friendly relations with Japan because Japan, you know, took on the arrogant Euro-Americans. And Japan also showed to Muslims that you can become modern and still be Muslim because the Japanese didn't become Christian. And at the time, you know, this drove certain Euro-Americans crazy. So you have not only the Yellow Peril, which Vancouver, you know, knows all too well with the 1907 race riots. But perhaps a little less known is the fact that there are people both in Europe and in the United States, it's driving them nuts that these people who seem to be non-white and non-Christian have modernized. And so, well, actually, the Japanese are pretty fair complexion, so maybe they are white, okay? Because otherwise, how could they have modernized? And, well, maybe they're actually the lost tribe, okay? Because that would explain why they're able. I mean, it's just driving people nutty. But, you know, if you fast forward to the 21st century, we don't even, the average young person, you know, to the extent that the term modernity means anything to them, I mean, China, India, I mean, it's worldwide. No one denies at this point that it belongs to the world, but that was not the situation in the late 19th century and early 20th century.
Speaking of the 21st century, if we gave you a time machine and said you can go back to any time in Japanese history and take along any sort of tool, technology, what have you, where would you go? When would you go? And what would that thing be?
Wow. Yeah. I think this was not a happy time in Japanese history, but I think I would actually like to experience the immediate post-surrender period, because it's one of these curious times where, I mean, a nation of 70 million people, to a considerable extent, has given all for a particular ideology and a particular conflict in the name of that ideology. And it's a complete failure. And it's like there's this incredible spiritual vacuum, and what do you fill it with? And, you know, Japanese at the time filled it with a lot more than what the Americans had to offer. They filled it in all different ways. And so for me, it's even perhaps more of a dramatic turning point than after the Meiji Restoration, which would be another, I mean, the two periods would be a couple decades during the Meiji period and then the immediate post-surrender period, because these are the big, you know, turning points, and it would be interesting to be able to see that firsthand, no matter how hard we try to understand it through all the text and all. I suspect that, yeah, having experienced it firsthand would provide a different understanding.
If you could introduce one thing to the people at that time, what might you give them from the present day?
I think that I would have suggested to the Japanese, I probably would have been disowned by my own government, that that they might do better than to throw in their lot with the U.S. after the war, that they might have done better to be neutral. This is actually a case where maybe they really didn't have a choice in the end, because it's almost like a scene from The Godfather or something, where the Japanese are like, we want our independence, and the Americans are like, well, we have needs too, or something. And then, so they don't, in a sense, have a lot of choice, but that they could have gone more independently in the post-war period, yeah. And then earlier, if the Japanese had said that the whole international system of racism is a disgrace, let's say they do it after the Russo-Japanese War. They're like, we proved modernity belongs to the world. Just, you know, there's no, how can anybody deny that? And then they had said, and we're just not participating in this international system of racism. We think it's absolutely shameless. Japan, incredibly enough, would have the heroic status today that conservatives in Japan wrongly claim for it. When they start talking about how Japan tried to put a racial equality clause in the Versailles Treaty, and they don't understand that Japan, all the Japan at the time is caring about is Japan and stuff, and they're not caring about other people. I mean, if they had actually, you know, done that, they would not only have this still very interesting and very important in terms of global history role of having proven that modernity belonged to the world, but they would have been way ahead of the curve and totally on the right side of history to say that, you know, racism is just a disgrace and stuff. And I don't know if that would have brought down the international system of racism any sooner, but Japan would, you know, Japan would have a genuine heroic status that it does not have as a result of having become a predatory imperialist itself.
Would you say Japan was fascist?
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting topic for me because I guess I learned a hard lesson this way. In my second book, there's some line in the introduction that basically says that, you know, I'm not hanging the importance of this book on whether or not Japan was fascist, but I happen to think that it's as good a term as any of the other ones that we've ever used. I mean, what does militaristic mean? You know, and was Nazi Germany not militaristic? I mean, what does corporatist, I mean, you know, Shell Guerin has put forth corporatist, and I'm trying to think, what are the other terms that have been applied to Imperial Japan? Well, militarist is the most common and stuff. And
quest for autonomy.
Things like that and all. That, for me, you know, fascism worked as well as any of the others, especially if you wanted to bring across the fact that you just can't blame all this on the state. And the people were not the rubber dolls that they had been when Fukuzawa's writing about them in the years after the Meiji Restoration, that they play a very significant role. And there's a tremendous amount of bottom-up movements, that fascism is as good as any other term. Well, the thing that kind of surprised me about some of the reviews, and maybe we should just get rid of book reviews because, I don't know, I mean, it just people just, for the most part, just use a book review to write about whatever they're interested in and stuff and all, and it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the book, was that several people just seized on the fascism issue. You know, either my definition was wrong or, like, you know, Japan was definitely not fascist, and it's like, well, but all I said that it's you know, all I'm saying is that I don't believe that anybody else has come up with a better term, and maybe we should at least consider fascism because we need to remember the bottom up. And people just, there's this whole industry of arguing over fascism that doesn't even necessarily have anything to do with empirical research and all, and I was found that to be somewhat tiresome. So, but my response to them would be, well, tell me what it is then. Okay, and you know, and maybe we don't use a single term, but do you, I mean, I never had any of them, all they ever did was say that it wasn't fascist, but they never were able to supply any better term that we might use for the era.
What else do you call mass cultural support for militarism and expansion? An ideology that that labels any sort of criticism as unpatriotic?
Jingoistic, but I mean, what, you know, gosh, I mean, the U.S. is pretty jingoistic at the moment, so where does that take you? And so I found that, I mean, it was a good lesson to me that I guess, you know, if you're going to use these terms, that people are going to come out of the closet because their whole scholarly careers are predicated on maintaining their definition of fascism or something like that. But for me, it wasn't so much as important as what I felt was, frankly, overwhelming empirical evidence that I provided of significant action at the popular level. And just interpret it, you can interpret it with whatever term you want, frankly, if you're that bothered by fascism or something, but at least recognize the empirical evidence that shows, you know, millions of people going and providing volunteer service to beautify imperial tombs and stuff like that. I mean, there was a significant popular agency to all this, and it was definitely not just the Japanese government pulling the wool over everybody's eyes.
I think I'm reminded of Yoshimi Yoshiaki just had a grassroots fascism book that was translated into English and tells a very similar story. I mean, there is this popular level movement supporting the war effort, and it's when you read oral histories and you look at after the war, I mean, we can say very kind of cynically, well, after the war, everybody knew the war was a bad idea.
Right. Yeah.
Everybody was against the war the whole time. But then, you know, you're looking at the culture in, like, or you're reading your book Imperial Japan at Zenith, Louis Young's book about war fever, about Manchuria in 1931, it really does make you question this. You know, people did seem to be supporting it, at least outwardly, mm-hmm. you know, inner reservations aside. But of course, that leads to other questions about collaboration, support, resistance.
Yeah, I mean, and actually, I should really strongly emphasize that Yoshimi Yoshiaki had his theory of grassroots fascism out, you know, before I wrote my book, and I cited him. But I would perhaps even take it in a little different direction. I mean, for me, the Dark Valley myth has been an ongoing aggravation. I think it's a thoroughgoing myth. If you're going to talk about Dark Valley, there's a couple of things that you have to define really carefully. When exactly? I mean, do you mean the last year of the war, when the war is finally brought to Japan? If you do, then I'll buy, you know, Dark Valley. Or do you actually mean what the colonized people were undergoing for pretty much the whole time that they were colonized? There you have a Dark Valley, arguably, although even in terms of the colonized, some are doing very well under the Japanese and others are not. So it's complicated there. But in terms of the Japanese, I just don't see it. And one of the ways that I tried hard to really, you know, try to put the biggest possible nail in the coffin of this Dark Valley nonsense was by tracing the fact that the Japanese were touristing the archipelago and the empire in the middle of the war and having a good old time. And often the tourism, when it came to the empire, involved visiting the heroic battle sites where the Imperial Army had just won an important battle and relishing it, loving it. And so I think the Dark Valley myth is one of the more pernicious portrayals of Imperial Japan. At this point, I think few scholars take it seriously. But at the popular level, it still gets bandied about a lot in Japan.
So your two monographs have both focused on the emperor system. But there's a lesser-known third work that deals with the emperor's naked army marches mm-hmm. on. Before we talk about that specifically, I mean, would you, if you were to take a step back and say, what is it that intrigues you as a historian that made you come onto these three topics? Is it the imperial system, or is it the kind of whole culture around the emperor system, or right. something entirely different?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's that I was especially attracted to taboo topics when I was starting out. And so, for example, when I was doing my master's, it was just after the Motoshima Hitoshi, the mayor of, I can't believe this, I must be getting older and older. It's got to be Nagasaki. It's not Hiroshima and stuff.
The one who was assassinated for
He was shot. He was shot. But he wasn't for having said that the emperor, too, bears responsibility. Right. I mean, a very mild statement. And I was like, wow. You know, the Imperial House is still, you know, a volatile issue in Japan. I mean, people get shot for that, and there's all these taboos. And so he was attracted to that, and that's probably why we were attracted to that movie, because it's an incredible taboo-breaking movie. And then the second book, I was choosing between two topics, the political right in post-war Japan or the 2600th anniversary celebrations, and I went with the anniversary, and it was a lot of fun, and I can't tell you how many times that just average Japanese, somehow, you know, it would come up what I was studying, and they would basically, their heads would, like, drop to their knees, and they'd be like, why are you studying that? It's a very embarrassing moment in the national history, and I'd be sort of like, well, that's precisely why I'm studying it, is to push it back into the public consciousness. You know, that's what I, just a personal opinion, but I can kind of consider to be good history. One form of good history is when people are pushing back into the public consciousness, precisely what lots of us would be just as happy to forget.
The
Meiji at 150 podcast is hosted by Tristan Gruno at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. This podcast would not be possible without the cooperation of the UBC Center for Japanese Research and the technical assistance of the UBC Faculty of Arts ISIT. Find out more about the Meiji at 150 project, including the Meiji at 150 lecture series, digital teaching resource, and workshop series by visiting our website, meijiat150.arts.ubc.ca. Thank you for listening.